With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, reporting from all the way in Florida today for the AgNet Media Citrus and Specialty Crop Expo. If you can hear the hustle and bustle in the background, that's what it is. But California lawmakers have introduced a bill to improve a federal disaster aid for farmers. Federal lawmakers from California have introduced legislation to create permanent disaster relief for U.S. farmers who lose crop revenue due to unprecedented climate events, including severe drought, massive wildfires, and flooding. The Agricultural Emergency Relief Act was announced last week by U.S. Senator Alex Padilla, Democratic Representative Mike Thompson of Napa, and Republican Representative Doug LaMalfa of Richville. The act would fortify emergency relief programs and enable Congress to appropriate supplemental disaster funds. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News report, and now let's get into our show headlines. AFBF economist is hopeful for a fall farm bill. American Farm Bureau Chief Economist Roger Krein is hopeful, despite delays, that lawmakers will produce a farm bill this fall that's ahead of the 2024 election year. Krein says Ag Committee staffs are working through the August recess to prepare farm bill texts for members when they return in September.
I think they'll put together some things in August. I think they'll work with whatever they do get from USDA and OMB and CBO. And we are very hopeful to get a farm bill in 2023, because it's going to be tough to do it in 2024.
Amid politics of a national election, but even now, the fight for scarce budget dollars is further threatening SNAP and conservation programs like CRP.
CRP programs, conservation programs should be about sustainable production, not sustainable not production. And there's an awful lot of money that was put into conservation in the Inflation Reduction Act that is being rather jealously guarded by the folks who put that in there. So there's going to be some real limits to how much of that will be available for anything else.
So just how tough is it to find savings to boost commodity programs?
There's going to need to be some additional funding from someplace for this safety net programs. But I'm personally not going to paint a target on any particular program.
Despite the obstacles, Krein says the leaderships of both ag committees in both parties want to get a farm bill done, spurring AFBF's optimism it will get done this year. NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
U.S. cotton growers are being reminded that the deadline to apply for the Climate Smart Cotton Program is September 1st. Applications for the program will be approved on a first-come, first-served basis, and senior scientist for the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, Chad Brewer, describes the three enrollment levels of the program.
The first level will be enrollment into the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, as well as making sure that the farmers upload their cotton bale production. That incentive for that part of the level one is $5 an acre, up to 706 acres per farming entity, which is a unique part of that program. Level two of the Climate Smart Cotton Program is where we actually begin to incentivize practice changes. We incentivize at $25 an acre for the implementation of cover crops, $5 an acre for going to a no-till production system, and then an additional $5 an acre when farmers develop a nutrient management plan. If those practices are implemented, then there's opportunity to move on to level three of the Climate Smart Cotton Grant, which would be entering into the carbon market, and this would provide additional funding for growers in that regard. The best way to enroll is to visit trustuscotton.org. The enrollment deadline is September 1, 2023.
Canada will once again be implementing additional temporary import requirements this fall for romaine lettuce from the U.S. The additional requirements implemented by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency will be in effect from September 28th to December 20th. Similar to last year's requirements, romaine lettuce, along with salad mixes that contain romaine lettuce, originating from the Salinas Valley counties of Santa Clara, Santa Cruz, Monterey, and San Benito, will have additional protocols to follow. Romaine lettuce products originating from those counties will have to provide negative test results for E. coli 0157H7 or a proof of origin for other U.S. growing regions. Canada has implemented additional import requirements for romaine lettuce from the U.S. during the fall since 2019. USDA points out that the additional rules have been a market disruptor since they were first introduced. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, nearly two dozen members of Congress, along with administration officials, economists, and sugar industry experts, just wrapped up the 38th International Sweetener Symposium, just in time for the Farm Bill. This year, the event focused on how Farm Bill policies support American food security.
There is strong bipartisan support for sugar policy from leaders in Congress. They really recognize the value and contributions our farmers, producers, processors, and workers provide to the American economy.
Cassie Bladow, incoming chairwoman of the American Sugar Alliance and president of the U.S. Beet Sugar Association, shared with us her biggest takeaways from this year's meeting.
We have been making the point to members of Congress that Americans benefit from having domestic sugar production, and we're seeing that message really resonate with members across the aisle. In addition, organizations across American agriculture, including the American Farm Bureau Federation and the National Farmers Union, agree we need to pass the Farm Bill with sugar policy intact.
There are more than 200 new members in Congress since the last Farm Bill. Many know very little about farm policy, let alone sugar policy, she said, but she is optimistic.
Gutting sugar policy would lead to a dependence on unreliable foreign suppliers, which in turn would cost us American jobs, farms, and domestic food security for this essential ingredient. It also hurts sugar-using companies who depend on a strong domestic industry to provide just-in-time delivery throughout the year. Nobody wins if sugar policy is weakened.
She called opposition to sugar policy short-sighted.
America's sugar industry keeps this essential ingredient in ready supply thanks to sugar policy, which operates at no cost to taxpayers. Sugar producers are an important economic engine for rural and urban communities. We support 151,000 jobs and contribute over $23 billion to the economy. We are confident that a farm bill that ensures Americans have a strong domestic food supply chain includes a robust sugar policy. This supports the needs of American family farmers and workers.
With the farm bill expected to be reauthorized later this year, sugar producers are advocating for sound farm safety net programs and U.S. sugar policy. In other news, U.S. Grains Council delegates recently elected Brent Boydstrom of Bayer Crop Science as chairman during their 63rd annual Board of Delegates meeting. He says the council plays an important role in U.S. agriculture.
A lot of folks just think about trade when they think about the U.S. Grains Council. That is the main part of what they do in helping facilitate those trade relationships. But it's more than that. One thing I've learned over my time is it's not just trade. You get into regulatory issues. You can get into issues around maximum residue levels that involve crop protectants. Some countries are a little bit leery about traits that farmers use to offer additional protections. It gets into uses of the products. In the case of ethanol and DDGs, this is all work that the council does.
In addition to working for Bayer, Boydstrom also has experience serving with the Colorado Farm Bureau and spent more than 7 years working on Capitol Hill, including work on trade policy. His theme for the year is growing the future.
I'm not going to lie. I came up with it sitting on a planter. You can't just plant a crop and then walk away from it. You have prep work you have to do. You plant it, you tend it through the season, you harvest it, you put it in the bin, you protect the grain until you ultimately send it to whoever you sell it to. That is the exact same of what Grains Council does. We go into places, into frontier markets. They develop those relationships. They develop those processes that are needed to help facilitate getting those U.S. corn, barley, and sorghum products into those emerging markets and those new markets. It's also working with our very established markets. It's not just a plant and walk away. It's not just meet and walk away. It's planting, it's meeting, it's tending that relationship for 1, 5, 10, 20, 50 years.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will be holding a hearing on August 23rd concerning the modernizing of the Federal Milk Marketing Order, or FMMO, system. It reflects the comprehensive approach to improvement that's been carefully crafted by the National Milk Producers Federation. Their president, Randy Mooney, said dairy farmers nationwide are grateful that USDA is moving forward by including the full scope of NMPS proposal to guide the dairy industry forward as it modernizes the Federal Milk Marketing Order system. Now, the hearing will begin August 23rd in Carmel, Indiana, and it is expected to last several weeks. NMPF's cooperative-led effort will be involved in every significant topic reflecting its detailed proposal and the nationwide scope of its effort. Mooney said, "The recognition of NMPF's consensus-based leadership allows us to continue the substantial momentum for change that we've achieved." He said there's still a long journey ahead towards a modernizing federal order system that works better for farmers, but with co-op-led efforts well underway to ensure that we're well prepared for the FMMO hearing. He said we're excited to lead the industry towards solutions that will offer benefits for everyone. In other news, the U.S. Senate has established a veterinary medicine caucus for the first time ever. The caucus will focus on increasing awareness towards veterinary-related matters in Congress, educating lawmakers and their staffs about the challenges facing the profession, and advancing the legislation that benefits the veterinary community. Now, the bipartisan caucus will be led by Cindy Hyde-Smith from Mississippi and Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. In past years, the House Veterinary Medicine Caucus led the way in introducing key legislation that impacts veterinary medicine, such as the Rural Veterinary Workforce Act and the Healthy Dog Importation Act. The Senate caucus will extend these efforts to their side of the chamber while also helping secure important funding for veterinary-related programs. According to Dr. Renee Carlson, AVMA president, the AVMA and the American Association of Veterinary Medical Colleges are dedicated to working with the caucus on raising awareness of the essential services that veterinarians provide and the challenges they currently face. And after a successful first year, the Wyoming Wool Initiative seeks donations for its second annual Lamb a Year program. While steer a year programs are common across the U.S., the Lamb a Year program is one of the first of its kind. The program connects donors with University of Wyoming students, allowing students to gain hands-on industry experience while providing producers with valuable lamb quality data. Now, producers are asked to donate a minimum of 2 feeder lambs, each weighing 70 to 90 pounds. In exchange, they'll receive data on the average daily gains and meat quality of their lambs, as well as a detailed performance report. Lamb drop-off and pickup dates are coordinated in September and October. You can learn more about this on the American Sheep Industry Association website, sheepusa.org. But if interested in donating, they need to hear from you by September 25th. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A new program aims to help farmers manage phosphorus. A series of 9 online training modules is now freely available to farmers, engineers, environmental consultants, and others interested in designing on-farm systems to remove phosphorus from field runoff or subsurface drainage. The modules comprise 7 narrated videos, starting with a basic overview of the need for phosphorus removal systems, followed by how to design, build, and install them, as well as how to properly dispose of or recycle the absorbent materials used to help capture the nutrient in drainage water and runoff. Phosphorus is a critical nutrient for optimal plant growth, health, and yield. However, that phosphorus leaves agricultural fields in runoffs or drainage water and can accumulate in bodies of surface water, like rivers and lakes, and that compromises that water's quality and triggers the growth and decay of algae blooms that can imperil aquatic life and recreational activities. To find a link to the training modules, visit our website at agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. A revised rule has changed the landscape for deducting casualty and theft losses. In a recent case, a couple discovered the unfortunate result of the theft loss disallowance rule. Before 2018, a theft loss was deductible in the year the theft is discovered. But under current law, a theft loss is only deductible if it is incurred as part of a federally declared disaster. The inability to deduct a theft loss was illustrated in a recent case. The taxpayers retired from their pet food business in 2016 and turned it over to their daughter. She scammed them out of almost $2 million, $1.1 million of which was from their retirement accounts and pension. The parents claimed a theft loss deduction, but the IRS said no, and that they owed over $400,000 in tax on the distributions. The court agreed. The distributions were taxable because the taxpayers were the ones that took the distributions in their own name. To make matters worse, they couldn't claim a deduction for a theft loss because the theft was discovered in 2019 and the theft loss deduction at that time was suspended until 2026. The court noted that this was a horrible result for the taxpayers, but that was what the law required. At least they were over age 59 and a half, so they didn't have to pay the 10% penalty on the distributions. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
Out here on the mall in Washington a while back, I was intrigued to find what we used to call a crop dusting plane. And also, I found a helicopter. They didn't fly in. They had to be trucked in here since you're not allowed to fly over Washington for obvious reasons. Standing beside the aircraft, we found Jim Perrin.
I'm an operator from Wisconsin, and I fly fixed-wing aircraft there in Wisconsin.
Glad they fixed the wing, so don't want an accident. He laughs politely at a joke I'm sure he's heard 100 times before. And speaking of 100, turns out the ag aviation industry, or aerial application, or to use the older term, crop dusting industry, is well into its 100th year. Yeah, and Jim, you've been flying ag missions for, what, how many of those 100 years?
This is my 30th season. Wow. And in that 30 years, the changes and advancements in technology are pretty impressive.
Well, I can see one of those right here. No more of those old-time open cockpit biplanes in the business, right?
No, thank goodness. I've got air conditioning, and I need air conditioning.
Well, we can use that out here today, too. But what else besides the AC is new?
Everything's done via GPS. For instance, when I land, my wife will email me a job file with a shape file. That'll pop up on my computer screen inside the airplane. We could take a look at whether the weather's suitable for doing it, and then go ahead and have the crew mix up the load for that. Go out, spray that field with the prescription that's got to go on that individual field.
So when they talk about using GPS and computers for ground equipment, tractors and such, for what they now call precision agriculture, you flyers, you're doing the same thing.
We are indeed precision ag. We can do all of that, variable rate, prescription mapping, that kind of thing.
Well, that sounds very professional. Now, back in the 70s, I have to tell you, many of the ag pilots I interviewed back then were kind of wild, a little devil-may-care. So, Jim, is that close to what some of the ag pilots were really like?
That's right.
Yeah. But today now, how about now?
Those days are gone. It is a professional that's doing that job. I think throughout the industry, we've seen a promising surge in professionalism.
And business is pretty good, too. Jim Perrin tells me in the U.S. each year, aircraft spray 127 million acres of cropland. 28% of all the crop protection materials used in this country are delivered by air. From the mall on the ground here in Washington, D.C., Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Rick Zimmerman is Vice President of State Affairs for NCTA, the Internet and Television Association. He talks about how those investments can be used most wisely to help close the digital divide that still exists.
I think there's really three key things from our perspective. One is to really focus on the unserved. Two, to avoid waste, fraud, and abuse. And three, to work with experienced, trusted broadband providers. I think those are the three keys for making this money go a long way.
Zimmerman says there are concrete steps that state leaders can take to ensure that those funds get maximized to deliver high-speed broadband to the unserved as quickly and effectively as possible.
There's a process laid out by the federal government working with the states. Every state has its own broadband office. They have to create a grant process, and there are a number of parameters in the federal statute and the guidelines, but basically it's priority number one, again, the unserved. So there's a map that the feds have created and the states are refining to identify those particular areas. And then two, it's encouraging providers to come in and bid to serve those areas. And three, there is a match requirement, a minimum of 25%, and many providers are going to offer to match an even greater amount, and that will help the money go further to ensure that every unserved area is served.
He says cable broadband providers are good, proven partners for state leaders in closing that digital divide.
Well, we have years of expertise in building, maintaining, upgrading networks. We have built next generation networks across the country. We're available to 85%+ of the country with gigabit download speed, fiber-rich networks. And we also have deep experience with workforce management, with supply chain. So that's why cable providers really sort of have a leg up because of that experience.
Rural residents without access to high-speed broadband can take steps to move the process along.
One is that even individual unserved homes are eligible this time around. That's kind of new for these kind of programs. Reach out to your state broadband office. One of the rules here is community engagement, listening sessions. They are supposed to be hearing from everyone, so you should feel free to do that. And local providers also have a wealth of information that they can share and assist. For our part, we are committed to the success of this program, to getting everyone served, and look forward to working with state broadband officials and individuals to make all of that happen.
Again, that's Rick Zimmerman of NCTA. Chad Smith reporting.
They read the news, keep track of government programs that help those in need, and even pretend to be a close friend or family member to help you apply for benefits or allege a need for immediate help. And AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says scams are big business.
Consumers report losing $8.8 billion to fraud in 2022, according to the most recent data from the Federal Trade Commission. That's a 30% increase from 2021. The biggest losses were to investment scams, including cryptocurrency schemes, which cost people nearly $4 billion.
Voskel says scams come in many shapes and sizes and are often tailored to a specific situation.
This time of year, there are lots of weather-related disasters and scammers that follow. It's important for folks to be on the lookout for post-disaster scams and how to spot them. Situations like asking you to pay an application fee to help qualify for FEMA funds, promising immediate repairs, or claim to be from the government and demand your bank account number. For farmers and ranchers, it may be fraudulent offers for goods and services, such as purchasing hay or cattle, or offers for different work around the farm requiring upfront payment.
In addition, new data from AARP shows veterans are often targeted by scammers as well.
The survey found criminals are taking advantage of veterans' lack of awareness by offering fraudulent benefits claims assistance with promises of lucrative benefits. One in 10 veterans say they were contacted by someone offering to assist them in enrolling in programs by a caller who guaranteed a payoff, which is a telltale sign of a scam.
Learn how you can spot and prevent scams Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Clements reporting.
Wildfire season is underway out west. No surprise, given the time of year and climate conditions. Hot, dry summer in most of the region. What was somewhat unexpected was the late start to mass wildfire activity. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey explains.
Because we had such an abundant, bounteous wet season across the west, it has taken a few extra weeks for things to start drying out, especially in the higher elevations.
So this past spring,
for the months of May and June, it seemed like all we were really talking about were the Canadian wildfires, which have burned a record amount of forested land across the Canadian provinces and territories. But for the United States as a whole, we got well into July before we saw extensive wildfire activity.
The numbers for U.S. wildfire activity for the first 7 months of 2023, Alaska included, look like this.
We saw only 1.2 million acres of vegetation burned across the country during the first 7 months of the year, and that compares to the 10-year average of about 3.8 million acres, so less than one-third of the typical acreage burned during the first 7 months of the year.
Those numbers include an expansion of heat into northern and western parts of the region, and an increase in wildfires during the last week of July.
We also saw the development of the monsoon circulation that contributed lightning strikes, and that also started several dozen small to medium-sized fires in the southwestern U.S.
Several dozen significant wildfires were reported by early August in various parts of the West.
The largest U.S. wildfire to date is the York Fire. It's a fire burning in a desert area near the California-Nevada border. As of early August, we've seen approximately 94,000 acres of desert vegetation burned by that wildfire.
Yet containment efforts of that complex are complicated, part due to fire skipping between fuels such as sagebrush and juniper trees, and part due to recent thunderstorm activity.
One of the more interesting fires that we've seen in recent days crossing the international border, that's the Eagle Bluff Fire, which started in northern Washington and then proceeded to burn northward into British Columbia, Canada. That fire required rare coordination between international agencies fighting the fire to discuss how to approach the firefighting efforts as it's crossed the international border.
Rippey adds, one of the most destructive fires this season is an example of how even small wildfires can cause damage. The Golden Fire in Oregon
only burned a little over 2,000 acres before being mostly contained, but it burned through a populated area, unfortunately, and also a campground. According to latest numbers, we saw more than 3 dozen residences and several dozen more outbuildings destroyed by that fire.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
As harvest begins, the American Seed Trade Association reminds farmers to be diligent in taking the proper precautions to ensure treated seed does not enter the domestic or export grain supply. When properly handled, seed treatments are an effective agronomic tool that provides seeds the necessary protection for a strong, healthy start. Completely remove all treated seed left in containers and equipment used to handle harvested grain and dispose of it properly. Always be careful to follow state and federal guidelines for proper handling, storage, and disposal of treated seed. For more information, visit seed-treatment-guide.com or contact your seed dealer.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, again reporting from Florida at the Agnet Media Citrus and Specialty Crop Expo. Today for our interview segment, Agnet West, Brian German chatted with Judy Culberson about the California Agriculture in the Classroom Conference that's coming up in September.
We're joined by Judy Culberson this morning, Executive Director of the California Foundation for Agriculture in the Classroom. And we're talking about the annual conference that's going to be coming up here fairly soon. And so, Judy, what's on the agenda for this year's event?
We are really excited about hosting our annual California Ag in the Classroom conference here in Sacramento. And we've traditionally gone north and south when we host our conference. Last year was in Ventura, and that was after a 3-year hiatus We were really excited that we had more than 160, 170 participants. So these are teachers coming from throughout the state and everybody kind of coming together to network and learn about how to include agriculture in their classroom. So this year, our conference is being held at the Holiday Inn in downtown Sacramento, September 22nd through the 24th, in conjunction with the Farm to Fork Festival. And that is a festival that celebrates all that the processes are between farmers and ranchers getting to your dining room table. So we have a great agenda planned starting on Friday afternoon, September 22nd. We are going to be starting our conference off with a real live Western barbecue out at a cattle ranch. And on the way to that cattle ranch Friday afternoon, we will be stopping at two or three different farms and ranches along the way. So the teachers always really appreciate getting to see real live farms and ranches and have an opportunity to visit with farmers and ranchers. So we'll be making a couple stops and we will be then enjoying a big barbecue at our cattle ranch. On Saturday, it's going to be a really packed full day. We start out early in the morning. We have a couple different workshop sessions, and then we're going to be walking to the Farm to Fork Festival, which is being held in downtown Sacramento all day that Saturday. And while the teachers are there, we really hope that they'll have an opportunity to talk with different farmers and ranchers and kind of look at the whole process from farm to fork. We are really excited to be partnering with Visit Sacramento and hosting a stage presence, a 45-minute panel that will include a farmer, a trucker, a processor, and then a grocery store. So we think that's really going to be helpful to kind of let everybody, not only our teachers, but everybody in the audience, understand really what it takes to get our food from the farm and actually available to you in stores or restaurants or wherever. So we come back to the hotel in the afternoon and we're going to have a panel of authors. These are local California authors who have written books about or that include agriculture. And we're very excited to have that. We'll have a book signing immediately following that. And then we'll take a little break and we'll be celebrating California agriculture with a dinner that we call a Taste of California. And the Taste of California dinner is always full of fun. Michael Marks, your produce man, a local celebrity here in Sacramento, will be wandering among different tables that are sponsored by different agricultural organizations to see what the teachers have learned about different commodities, different educational programs, different nonprofits who are also teaching about agriculture. So that is just a really fun event. Everybody thinks of that as a highlight. And Sunday, we are excited to have Frank Mitlohner, who is a UC Davis professor, present to our audience talking about livestock and its impact on the environment. I'm sure that's going to be a real winner. And we look forward to that presentation. We are going to be having a farmer panel, which is maybe the biggest highlight for the conference. We invite a variety of farmers and ranchers to come in and they talk about their operations. And then we have a lot of time for questions and answers. And the teachers just truly do appreciate getting to hear from the mouth of those who produce our food and fiber, and always another highlight for the conference. But we think it's really, really important that teachers have an opportunity to come together. They network with each other. Very often it's teachers presenting to teachers, and really it's motivating teachers to include agriculture in their classroom. Ag in the classroom kind of can fit into any subject area, whether it is math, perhaps you're measuring and graphing plants that you're growing in your garden, or in your classroom, whether it's spelling, you can include the word irrigation, and it starts a discussion about what irrigation is by having students learn how to spell that word. Obviously, agriculture fits perfectly in science, but it really is in English. As I said, we have authors who have written books that include agriculture. So we really try to make sure that teachers understand this is a subject that is not going to add on to your schedule and your workload, because we all know that teachers are always overworked. But it's a subject that can make your life in the classroom come alive. It really helps students with hands-on opportunities. Students are going to remember when they taste and teach something in the classroom, or if they grow a plant and then have the opportunity to taste what that plant tastes like. We have so many wonderful stories from teachers who talk about how just including agriculture, food, fiber, flowers, forest, and fuel, that's how we define agriculture and help people remember what a broad industry it is. But bringing that into the classroom has really helped a lot of students, no matter how they learn. Sometimes it's the troublemaker that all of a sudden takes ownership of growing that plant. And maybe they have the best, you know, the largest plant that has been grown. And it just really can do a lot for individual students. Teachers seem to really thrive. And we're excited that at the conference, traditionally, 50% of the people are brand new. And we're really grateful for them taking time out of their private lives to come see what this is all about. And then half the audience is returning folks. And that really lends itself to the communication, the mentoring, the networking that goes on during the conference. And the fact that all these teachers are from different grade levels, different backgrounds, it just really is a nice common denominator.
And to learn more about the organization and the annual conference coming up on September 22nd through the 24th, you can visit learnaboutag.org.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Farm Credit continues strong support for beginning farmers. Farm Credit continued its strong support for beginning farmers during 2022. That was detailed in a report of the Farm Credit Administration's board meeting, where it issued the annual report on Farm Credit systems lending to young, beginning, and small farmers. FCA, Farm Credit's federal regulator, focused on the financial safety and soundness of the farm credit system. CEO Todd Van Hughes says, quote, supporting the next generation of farmers and ranchers remain a key component of Farm Credit's mission. In 2022, Farm Credit made 78,742 loans to beginning farmers worth over $21.5 billion. He also says in the past 3 years, Farm Credit made more than 270,000 loans totaling more than $70 billion to beginning farmers and ranchers. He adds, quote, the Farm Credit Administration's report confirms Farm Credit's consistent support for beginning farmers. When adjusting for the strong demand from pandemic-era programs, loan growth to beginning farmers stayed strong. NAFB contributed to that report.
Dairy industry members are being encouraged to participate in the process of developing the 2025-2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. As part of that process, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee meets 6 times to review evidence and draft conclusions for its report, which will inform the final guidelines. The public's invited to attend the 3rd committee meeting scheduled to take place online September 12th and 13th. During the meeting, the committee will hear from the public, discuss progress made on its review since the 2nd meeting, and make plans for future work. The first day of the meeting will include virtual oral comments from the public. The Dairy Council of California continues to engage in the development process in advocating for the important role that milk and dairy foods play in healthy eating patterns. The council's encouraging members of the dairy community to get involved and provide feedback. Registration to attend the meeting and sign up to provide comments is available at dietaryguidelines.gov. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Orange juice prices to surge higher. Expect higher orange juice prices in the months ahead after a bacterial disease and harsh weather ravaged this season's crop. Florida annually produces more than 90% of the country's orange juice supplies. Last year, Florida was hit by Hurricane Ian, Hurricane Nicole, and freezing conditions. The Guardian says producers also had to battle citrus greening disease. It's spread by an invasive insect and can't be cured, so it renders affected fruit unusual. Infected trees typically die within a few years, and that's forced some producers to give up growing fruit and selling their land. Industry expectations say that U.S. production will reach its lowest point in more than 100 years. A trade group says the industry typically does about 244 million boxes of oranges, but ended up this year with under 16 million boxes. Up to 10% of the state's orange trees were lost in the hurricanes. NAFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.